From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. It was called the One Big Beautiful Bill, and it promised massive tax cuts for America. But to many in the states, the beauty was definitely only in the eye of the federal government beholders. Here in Oregon, a group of legislators is even going so far as to try and detach the state from the federal law. Today on the show, you'll hear from a key sponsor of that proposal and also from a business group that opposes it. It's a battle of the feds versus the state on who gets to decide Oregon tax policy. Then, in the second part of the show, our own Rachel McDonald talks about a recent tragic accident in Eugene and how a coalition of residents and officials are trying to improve road safety. That's next on Oregon on the Record. H.R. 1, the massive federal tax bill, has fans and haters. Today on the show, you'll hear from both. First, we talk to a senator from Bend who wants to literally detach Oregon from the bill. Senator Anthony Broadman, a Democrat from Bend, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael, how are you?
I'm good. So, as I understand it, you and Representative Nancy Nathanson from Eugene have put forth this proposal aimed at the federal bill that passed last year called H.R. 1. What does your proposal do, or what does it entail?
Well, the number one thing it does is put more money in Oregonians' pockets and invest in Oregon businesses. This is a time when life has become really expensive for Oregonians as a result of Trump's tax package, H.R. 1, or some people call it the Big Beautiful Bill. It's not beautiful at all for Oregonians. It's causing people to have to spend more just to survive. And it's a tax cut for primarily the wealthy that doesn't help us grow businesses here and makes life more expensive.
Yeah, remind folks what H.R. 1 specifically would do to Oregon.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. We are connected to the federal tax code in Oregon law. And so this billionaire tax cut that the Trump administration and Congress passed, it took $900 million out of our state budget overnight. And that happens automatically because Oregon's tax code is connected to the federal tax code.
Okay. And then so kind of explain, you know, how your proposal would work and maybe take us through how it, you know, how it can go from proposal to actual bill and kind of where it would go from there.
Sure. So it does two primary things. It increases the earned income tax credit for the lowest earning Oregonians, puts more money in their pockets at a time when life is becoming more and more expensive. It creates the Oregon Jobs Tax Credit, which lowers taxes for businesses that grow jobs in Oregon. And it does that by cutting aspects of H.R. 1 that are primarily aimed at benefiting larger businesses and the wealthy.
Okay. When a federal bill gets passed, and I'm sorry if this is like basic civics and maybe I was out that day, but I mean, does it supersede a state law? Is it within the purview of the state legislature to say, hey, guess what? We're not going to accept these conditions from this federal piece of legislation.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're doing. We're passing Oregon tax laws that reflect Oregon values. So normally, Oregon's tax code connects directly to the federal tax code. We have taxable income defined the same way as federal taxable income. This is a moment that we've heard from, you know, nurses, law enforcement, educators. This is a moment where Oregon's tax code needs to reflect Oregon's values, and that we should not just blindly copy the Trump tax code because it's not fair. It's not good for businesses and it's not good for Oregonians for whom life is getting more expensive.
I imagine perhaps on the other side of the aisle, there may be opposition to this proposal. What would you say to them?
Yeah, there is opposition. I'm naive enough to think that this was going to be a bipartisan agreement because it does support the people who need the help the most. It does cut taxes for businesses who grow jobs. But what I would say is that this is a balanced approach. the provisions that we are changing when it comes to businesses and the wealthy are ones that other states have changed. So we are ending one category of bonus depreciation, and that is an aspect of the federal tax code that is true for the majority of states in the union. So I would say, you know, to the opposition of this, who suggests that it's harmful, that we want to be in a bigger group of states because we do need to compete with other states for the jobs and the businesses and the growth in our economy that we know our state needs.
Yeah, and I think I saw a quote from your colleague, Representative Nathanson, saying that this measure could really help our state be more competitive in doing business. Expand upon that.
I think by really focusing on what we need in Oregon from a business perspective, from an economic growth perspective, it's pretty simple, right? It's jobs. It's more jobs, higher paying jobs. And this bill rests on this new jobs tax credit that is going to directly lower costs for businesses who are hiring more Oregonians. And I hope that is the message that you know, business owners like me across our state hear loud and clear. Oregon's open for business, and jobs tax credits are a way of exclaiming that. Mm-hmm. Look, if you grow jobs in Oregon, we want to support you. What we don't want is to ship tax benefits outside of our state to mega corporations who take advantage of our, I think, healthy economic environment here.
I know HR 1 was passed a while ago. Do you feel as more time has passed since its passage, has it become more unpopular as people sort of see the where the rubber meets the road?
Yeah, we're not dumb, right? We know what these Trump cuts have done. They've made life more expensive. HR 1 is going to cause the lowest quintile, the lowest 20% of households, to lose on average $165 in income in 27. And next year, the top 0.1% of households are going to gain an average of over $300,000 in income. We've already paid per household another $1,700 plus in higher costs in the first year of Trump's presidency. That's on average, an Oregon household has paid $1,700 more in higher costs just in the first year of Trump's presidency.
He's Senator Anthony Broadman from Bend. Senator, always great to talk to you. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, Michael. Appreciate it.
Now you'll hear from a business group who is vehemently opposed to Senator Broadman's proposal. Angela Wilhelms, the president and CEO of Oregon Business and Industry, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I know that several Oregon legislators are offering a proposal that basically says Oregon would reclaim state money lost to HR 1. What's your organization's position on this proposal from Senator Broadman and Representative Nathanson?
Yeah, I want to be really clear here. There are actually three parts to this so-called bill.
Okay.
One is auto loan interest deductions that are now but would not be available to individual Oregonians who need to take out a loan to buy a car, who can't afford to, you know, plunk down the cash to pay for that in full. Second is a Clinton-era policy. It's not a Trump policy. It's a Clinton-era policy known as Section 1202, which relates to qualified small business stock. That's in the title, small business stock. It's a decades-old program that allows small and growing companies to reinvest more in their own people and growth. And companies using it here are smaller, mid-sized companies rooted in Oregon. And then the third provision is really about timing. And so this is where we get a little confused when they talk about how it's going to increase revenue. It does a short-term thing, but it creates a long-term, on balance, there's no change in revenue. This is entirely about a tool called bonus depreciation that at its core is timing. So it changes when a company can expense things, and therefore it changes when the state will see revenue, but not whether the state will see that revenue. So they're actually cutting their nose off to spite their face, because they may see a little more today, but they'll see less in a few years. And they're taking away a tool that businesses can use, small and mid-sized businesses can use for growth.
I see. I think I even saw a quote from you saying something along the lines of disconnecting Oregon from federal tax definitions is short-sighted and a step in the wrong direction. Go ahead and elaborate on that.
Yeah, I mean, we're at a time in Oregon where we are losing private sector jobs year over year, especially in industries like manufacturing, agriculture, food processing, capital intensive businesses and industries. And those jobs can be in part recreated from tools like bonus depreciation, because you're giving Oregon companies, Oregon manufacturers, Oregon food processors, Oregon farmers, the ability to invest in that capital equipment that might allow them to become more energy efficient, might allow them to bring on a new product line and hire people. And it certainly can also increase property tax revenue. So it's this double-edged sword where you're taking away a useful tool at a time when Oregon's companies really need that help to create jobs. We're going the wrong direction. We need to reverse that. So it takes away that tool. And it just changes the timing at a time when actually the general fund is balanced.
Mm-hmm.
There's an ending fund balance in the budget. And that's from a report that came out last week. So they don't actually need general fund revenue. They have enough to fund the budget. This is where that money would go. And it just doesn't make any sense.
I see. When you look at what the legislature is doing in the short session and kind of juxtaposed to this particular proposal, are there tweaks to the tax code you think would be better serving Oregonians?
We've said for a long time at OBI that we have a great deal of interest in a comprehensive discussion about the state's tax structure. There are some, you know, pretty curious elements to it that make Oregon, once again, an outlier in ways that may not be helpful to Oregon. The heavy reliance on personal income tax, the heavy reliance on business and corporate income tax, some of the relationship between state and local taxation. So we're in for a conversation about tax reform. But it takes leadership to set that table and really have that conversation. And in the meantime, you know, sort of nibbling around the edges or making these small tweaks that only add complexity and risk revenue and economic growth, we got to avoid that. We say all the time, we got to put down the shovel and stop digging our hole. We've got to support the private sector. And then, yeah, we actually have to see some leadership and courage to set these bigger, hard tables.
Do you think that there's enough opposition to this proposal to sink it if it moves forward in the session?
Well, you know, I don't know. We certainly hope so. We're working on making sure that Oregonians understand that this is sort of a red herring, and they shouldn't be tricked into that the legislators have seen their budgets double since 2015, the 2015-17 biennium. I don't know many businesses or households that have seen their budgets double in that long. So we're trying to make sure people know the realities and facts about what's admittedly pretty complicated and wonky tax policy. But we believe Oregonians are smart enough to see through these red herrings, that they want to see real solutions around affordability and long-term budget sustainability, and that they know that you know, again, taking away tools that can help their local small manufacturer or food processor or other business grow and thrive, that is not what we need right now.
She's Angela Wilhelms, the president and CEO of Oregon Business and Industry. Angela, really appreciate you taking time to talk with us.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for your interest in the topic.
Now let's hear about how a terrible bike accident may help change the way a major arterial in Eugene is routed. You hear her on our air every afternoon, Rachel McDonald, the host of All Things Considered. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to me.
Yes, Michael, happy to do it.
In your studio. So you did this recent story about people demanding changes on Patterson Street in South Eugene. Why don't you just give us an overview of that story?
Yeah, so last month on January 25th, a 30-year-old PhD student was hit and killed by a car while riding his bicycle on Patterson Street at 22nd And now neighbors and advocates are urging the city to make some changes to the street. They say it's too easy to go fast on that street, and that they really want to see some changes to make it more safe.
Rachel, from what you've learned, talk about the cyclist who was killed.
Yeah, Eric Ninjui, who's from Kenya, he was 30 years old. He was a PhD student at the University of Oregon studying special education. And it sounds like in the short time of his life, in the short time he was at the U of O, he touched a lot of people. There's a lot of love for him. And people are working to raise money to send Eric's body back to Kenya for burial. And that GoFundMe has raised more than $74,000 so far. They've also said in the GoFundMe that those funds are also going to help support a wrongful death case against the driver. Another thing that I found out is that the University of Oregon College of Education has set up a memorial fund in Eric's name because he was someone who benefited from scholarship funds, from support. So it's a way of passing that forward.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's interesting because I was talking to the mayor fairly recently, and she said that's a big issue in our entire city, but certainly Patterson is a very fast street. But I think probably a lot of experts you talked to said, yeah, we have a speeding problem in our community.
That's right. And I think particularly on these types of streets where it's a one-way, like Patterson, with two lanes, it can be very confusing for drivers and for pedestrians and cyclists. For example, when someone's trying to cross the street and one vehicle stops to let them go, and the other vehicle comes along and is like, why are they stopping? And just kind of tries to pass them, which is very dangerous. So that's definitely an example. I know Highway 99, there has been a cyclist killed in the recent months. And even last August, another University of Oregon student was killed on a similar street that was 8th Avenue near the courthouse, where it's a two-way, two-lane, mm-hmm. one-way street.
Yeah, yeah. I drive that every day. And certainly it was interesting. You talked to a gentleman that people may know, Rob Zako, and he talked about Patterson is designed wrong in some ways. Talk about your conversation with him because he knows a lot about design and whatnot. Talk about what he said.
Yeah, really his message was that when you're on a street like that, it feels really easy to go fast. It's 25 mile per hour.
And I think probably a lot of people don't sort of acknowledge that.
Yeah, and it's really easy to go fast. It feels kind of like a highway. And yet at the same time, there's apartments there. It's close to two schools, the YMCA. There's a lot going on in that area. And Patterson is not the only one. I mean, he also mentioned Hilliard, which goes the other direction and is similar. And that one is even more busy and frequented by students. So it's really, as a driver, you need to be watching.
Yeah. And certainly, you know, I'm someone who drives by that area, but you also talk to people who live on that street.
Yeah.
You know, talk about some of the comments that they made to you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there was a lot of just concern about the fact that you are trying to cross those two lanes of one-way traffic. You might think, okay, those cars are way down there. They're not going to hit me. And then they come at you. So yeah, one of the residents, Christina Manning, who lives at Spencer View Apartments, said, you know, she kind of gave this example of, you think you have a lot of room to cross, and then suddenly the cars just speed up, and you're like, this is a quote from her, oh no, and rushing.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, it really shouldn't be that way. There are kids that live at Spencer View Apartments. It's family housing. And so there's just a lot of concern about the safety there, and especially after someone died there.
Yeah, yeah. What if, in addition to talking to Mr. Zako, you talked to some other folks or, you know, at the city. Is there a plan? What are some of the comments that some of the traffic experts are saying?
Well, I talked with Marion Suter Barnes, who's with City of Eugene Public Works, and she said that they are going to do a speed study. So basically the idea is they need to gather the information, the data, in order to make any plans for changes. So it doesn't sound like it's going to be a fast process.
Yeah.
You know, she did mention, though, and I think this is something worth letting you know. It wasn't in my story, but she said, you know, it actually is pedestrians have the right of way at any intersection, even if there's not a crosswalk. So that's something to know. And also that when you do see a vehicle stopped for someone to cross the street and you're coming up beside them, you actually are legally required to stop there too. So that was something I actually did not know.
And neither did I. No, that's very good information. Let me reintroduce you to the audience. We're talking to our own afternoon host, Rachel McDonald. Driving there now, there's a ghost bike, which are those white bikes that indicate a deadly accident occurred there. And there's signage.
Yeah.
For people who haven't seen it, it's in some ways, it's obviously it's terrible that it's there because of what happened. But it does make you kind of take notice. Talk about, you know, I know you snapped some pictures there.
Yeah.
Talk about what it feels like to see that.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely sobering. It has a sign that says Eric and Jui died here. That's the name of the cyclist who died on January 25th. It also, there's signs that say slow down. And there is that ghost bike, which right now is just covered with beautiful flowers and a photograph of Eric. And again, that just slow down. So people in the neighborhood, I think, are really trying to bring attention to this. And also it's a way, I think, for them to kind of let the city know, like, here we are putting these signs up because it's, you know, there's nothing else slowing people down.
Yeah, it's almost sad that a tragedy has to happen for that type of acknowledgement. And in the last part of your story, you talked about ways in which the public can engage as soon as tonight. Talk about that.
The organization Better Eugene Springfield Transportation, which is an organization that Rob Zako is a part of, they're holding a transportation safety community forum that's tonight from 6 to 8 p.m. at Roosevelt Middle School in Eugene.
She hosts All Things Considered for us here at KLCC. Rachel McDonald, thanks so much for coming in and talking about this important story.
Thank you, Michael.
That's the show for today. All episodes of Oregon on the Record are available as a podcast at klcc.org. Monday on the show, for President's Day, we talk to a local expert on the presidency and hear how individual executives have changed our nation. I'm Michael Dunn, host of Oregon on the Record. Thanks for listening.